maybe keep it quiet, because we do not want to be place undue worry, cause undue worry to other people. And this especially concerns, let's say, parents. They don't want to sort of, A, see their, let their children know how much they're suffering, let their spouses know, or even other family members know how much they're suffering, for example. And then also, because maybe, and they're also doing this. So, for example, if we're in great pain, we might also be a bit more prone to being what we would call reactive, which is, so reactive is a bit different to being responsive. Reactive is, you know, you can imagine if we're in pain, we might be more likely to snap, to say angry words, because, you know, maybe it's difficult. If the pain is really high, really big, then, you know, we might get more irritable more easily. But many people, alhamdulillah, and may Allah bless them, are able to sort of still control themselves and just use kind words towards other people. And obviously this is something that the martyr, Sayyid Jan Bozorgi, was able to do. And, you know, this is... And, you know, obviously, that, as I just said, there are times where we really need to be honest about the pain we're in. And to some extent, if people are in great pain and have a really serious disease, you know, we need to tell people so that obviously care can be arranged. But obviously, if we're still able to contribute in our families, in our society, still able to perform in the workplace, and if we're able to somehow access that level of patience and resilience, even towards pain, and still, in a sense, have that goodwill, have that love, have that compassion, and just that smile on our faces for the people around us, there's a huge blessing if we're able to access that level of, in a sense, resilience. So, inshallah, all of us can access that if we're in the position where, you know, we really need to be doing that. And that was it for today, and I look forward to welcoming you to another episode of 8:30 on Iron Bingish Radio, and farewell for now. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of A to Z. And for more information, please also visit our website at www.iranradio.ir.
When the whole world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Thank you for joining us. You are listening to Iran Radio, and here are some interesting facts about the Holy Quran I invite you to listen to. Surah Yasin is considered the heart of the Quran for its tremendous benefits for the believer. The best drink according to Quran is milk. In the Quran, Allah also describes the rivers of milk in the heaven. The best food according to Quran is honey, which cures several problems and is the sweetest gift to humans from Allah. Normally, the Quran declares Friday as the most blessed day of the week. The month of Ramadan is the best month of the year, and the night of Qadr has been described as a night better than 1,000 months. Its significance is described in Surah Al-Qadr. We are in the studio of Iran Radio with a full slate of engaging content, meaningful dialogue, and stories that stay with you long after the broadcast ends. So wherever you are, make yourself at home. You're just getting started. First, you'll hear more of our expertly crafted radio productions. Next is Youth Station. Following that, we bring you powerful insights from leaders' speech. Listen to English translations of selected statements and speeches by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution on various occasions, a source of profound wisdom. Then join us as we go around the world with reporters. Our correspondents from across the globe will bring you fascinating reports on a variety of subjects from their regions, offering a unique global perspective. So don't go anywhere. Up next is another segment of our radio productions.
There are scholars who delve into the complexities of geopolitics and international relations, examining the forces that shape global dynamics. Their work often bridges theoretical frameworks and practical implications, bringing insights into the interplay of security, economics, and diplomacy. Among them are those who focus on Eurasian integration and the evolving role of conservatism in global politics. My guest today exemplifies this dedication, contributing to academic discourse and shaping perspectives on international affairs. I am Bahman Nouray, your host. Welcome to SOAP.
Glenn Deason is a Norwegian political scientist and author born in 1979. He specializes in international relations, geopolitics, geoeconomics, and Russian foreign policy. His academic work often explores the interplay between security institutions, conservatism, and Eurasian integration. Deason has also contributed to journals like Russia in Global Affairs and authored several books on geopolitics and international relations.
Mr. Glenn Deason, it's a pleasure to have you here on SOAP.
Oh, thank you. It's my pleasure.
Thank you. I want to start with what in your childhood or maybe your teen years inspired you to get interested and go after geopolitics and international relations?
Well, I always had a bit of an interest, at least after the Cold War in the 90s. I was quite optimistic about the possibility for Europe to unify, a bit like what I've done with France and Germany, but then, we're bringing in Russia, so having a unified common Europe. When I was in the army in 98, 99, it was a bit of a disappointment to see that we were instead bombing Yugoslavia and creating a Europe without the Russians by expanding NATO. Now, but actually, initially I did a business degree, I had a master of business. I actually moved to Russia almost 20 years ago to explore commerce, common business interest, and I was swept away by their politics. So that's went back to uni and got re-educated.
Oh, that's interesting. Actually, I wanted to talk to you about, because you pursued degrees in commerce, business, international relations across multiple universities. That's what I wanted to ask, what took you in that path? And tell me, and of course, you speak Russian as well. Tell us about your experience in Russia. What did you find which was maybe different from the mainstream narrative of Russia?
Well, I moved there in 2006 because I wanted to look at some of the common economic interests, because both Norway and Russia, we have fisheries, natural resources. And so I studied there, Russian language and history. And what really took my interest, though, was outside of this, which was the narratives we told, because the stories we tell, what happened after the Cold War, what happened in the 90s, early 2000s, you hear the stories that the Russians say and what's coming out of the West. And we're talking about the same thing, but there's nothing in common. It's completely two different narratives. And often your first instinct is, oh, well, I guess it's, you know, Russians have propaganda. But then, you know, you look into it and you find out that actually their narratives have often more evidence to it. And instead, you find a lot of holes in your own narratives and you realize that, you don't understand your opponents anymore. And when you don't understand your opponents, you tend to pursue very foolish policies. And so I was immediately, took a great interest, not just in Russian history, but its politics as well.
You know, as a specialist in international relations, of course, why do you think that historically Europe has never been close enough with Russia rather than getting close with America?
Yeah, well, that is the absurd situation we have today, which is also a key flaw in the European security architecture. That is, the main European actor today is the United States, which is a non-European country. Meanwhile, the largest country in Europe in terms of population, territory, economy, military, so across the board, which is Russia. And they're the only country who's now demoted to not even being a European country. So one has to ask oneself, do we really think this is going to lead to stability? That, you know, at the moment, the foreign policy chief of the European Union, for example, is from Estonia, a country with, I think, about 1.3 million. Meanwhile, they have a seat at the table. Meanwhile, Russia, with 145 million, they do not have a seat. And then that begs the question, how do we recognize their security concerns? How do we accommodate this? And we don't. We don't even discuss Russian security concerns. It is quite remarkable. So one shouldn't be surprised that we end up in conflicts with the Russians if they're not represented, and we don't even talk about their security concerns.
And even now, when you think of it, the situation today, the United States is kind of going around Europe and talking to Russia. So it's kind of, Europe is out of the loop a little bit. Why do you think this has come to it?
Well, I think in this peace negotiations, I think the Europeans are seen as being unrealistic and unreliable by both Washington as well as Moscow. Now, this isn't even, it's worth noting that after the Russian invasion in 2022, you had President Macron of France. He actually tried to have some conversations with Putin, and the rest of the Europeans, they pulled him back, arguing, no, we don't do diplomacy with Russia. We're going to isolate them internationally. And he warned, actually, that, you know, if we don't talk to the Russians, then peace in Europe will be negotiated by a non-European power, which is now the United States. So the Europeans, they kind of handed this over. And no one's preventing them from picking up the phone and calling Moscow. But for 3 years now, they boycotted diplomacy while all these hundreds of thousands of young men died on the front lines. And they still don't want to pick up the phone and call Russia and try to get in and start some diplomacy. Instead, the key impulse now seems to be to try to undermine what Trump was, not a perfect peace, obviously, but what he was pursuing.
Right, and at the same time, I think there is some sort of, you know, disheveled look within the European Union regarding the issue of Ukraine. What policy are they exactly following right now?
I don't know, and I think this is a part of the problem. There's no strategic clarity. That is, it's not clear what they want to achieve. Some are saying that we can't negotiate, we have to win, but if we recognize that this is an issue, this is considered to be an existential threat to Russia, that means they will fight till the end, and Russia just happens to be the world's largest nuclear power. How exactly do we define victory? There is no victory, and indeed, what's been revealed is the Americans, they never really wanted to send so much weapon that they could destroy or defeat Russia, because that would be nuclear war. They realized this. They just sent enough weapons to bleed the Russians, that is, to send the Ukrainians to die and hope to kill some Russians and weaken a strategic adversary. But the idea that you can defeat Russia is foolish. So if you can't defeat the Russians, what is the goal? Are you going to negotiate with them? No, they don't want to do this either. You had the foreign policy chief talking about breaking Russia into pieces. They don't want to talk to Putin because they say he's a war criminal. So we don't do diplomacy. We want to take on the world's largest nuclear power. There's a lack of strategic thinking here, and I think this is really undermining our security in Europe.
And where do you think this is going now? How do you think this conflict is going to end?
Well, we're
what
losing
would you
it.
Bet on?
Well, NATO is losing the war. We're running out of weapons and we're running out of Ukrainians. So it's just going to get worse every day we wait. So every day we wait, Ukrainians lose more men. We have even less weaponry, and the Ukrainians lose more infrastructure, more territory. So it's, you know, the former advisor of Zelensky, Arestovich, he was saying we should take this deal by the Russians, that is neutrality and territorial concessions. And he recognized that if we don't give away four territories, we're going to lose eight. So I think in Europe, a key problem is there's wishful thinking. It's that we can't accept that Russia determines if Ukraine should be a part of NATO. So we're not going to let them have a voice. But if you don't let Russia have a voice, they will have to use military force, which is what they've done. If you don't accept a territorial concession, the alternative isn't to get all the territory back. It's to lose twice as much. And I think this is the problem. So people, they become very moralistic, and they take a very maximalistic position. And they think that this is somehow expresses their moral. Because, no, we will not accept one inch of Ukrainian territory lost. But if the alternative is, you know, hundreds of thousands of more Ukrainians dead, a nation destroyed, and even more territory lost, why is this moral? And no one seems to answer this.
Right. But do you think that if like wearing the shoes of Mr. Zelensky, for example, here, do you think that if this becomes sort of a pattern, if he agrees to this, anywhere else in the world there might be a conflict and then easily say, okay, you want to settle down? Okay, this part of your country now belongs to the other country, to your neighbor. It's fine. People are not going to get killed. Don't you think that this is going to like change the whole shape, geopolitical shape of the entire world?
Well, that's the premise in which we see now many Western countries do not want to give any concessions to Russia, because the narrative is, you know, this was an unprovoked invasion. The Russians invaded because they wanted territory. If we give them the territory, we right. reward them. So now we're sending a signal to the rest of the world. Anyone can go and take territory. Yeah. So if you accept the premise, then it makes sense. My point is, I don't buy into the premise. Russia never invaded because it wanted territory.
Right.
They've been saying since the 90s, we need a proper inclusive European security architecture. Yeah. Because when you expand NATO closer and closer to the Russian borders, exactly. it's considered yes. a threat. And it shouldn't be controversial. A lot of Western leaders, politicians, military leaders, intelligence officials, ambassadors, they all recognized throughout the years that this was an existential threat to the Russians. Even Angela Merkel once said that taking Ukraine into NATO would be considered a declaration of war against Russia. So we know that this wasn't about territory. The loss of territory is the symptom or the consequence of it. So I think if we recognize that the war started because Russia sees NATO expansion as an existential threat,
right.
then suddenly the lesson is very different. If we don't make any compromise now, it can only escalate, because there's no way Russia would ever accept NATO in Ukraine, or that Donbas should again fall into Ukrainian control. So one doesn't have to think this is just or good, but I think it's very dangerous, this premise we keeps pushing, that right. this was unprovoked and that they just won a territory.
Yeah.
It's again, it feels very moral, something we say, so we'll be the good guy, but it prevents yes. peace, because there's no solution to
right.
this conflict if we just say this is just the Russian imperialism.
Of course, Glenn, you know that the Ukraine conflict is not the only one currently in the world. We have the situation in the Middle East, in Gaza and Palestine, to be exact. You know, always, the narrative, the mainstream narrative is always that the collective West cares so much about issues like human rights issues, women and children issues, and that sort of stuff. But when it comes to the women and children in Gaza today, they seem to be, at the very best, indifferent. Why do you think this has become like this?
Well, as you said, I think the narratives become overwhelming. They're so dominant that facts have less to say. So again, all narratives and all conflicts around the world have to be framed somehow as a struggle between good and evil. With the Russians we have one, but in the Middle East it's the same. If you have, for example, these tensions between Israel and Iran, then well, Israel is the liberal democracy, freedom, human rights. Iran is like a terrorist state. It's a big Taliban camp, essentially. This is how Iran is portrayed. Yeah. And once something is the good versus evil, then people are often convinced that, you know, you can look away from some of this collateral damage because it's for a good cause. Often this would be the mindset. Now, I think, as you say, I think it's taking a... I think what's happened in Gaza has ruined a lot of... well, punched a hole in these narratives because it's very hard to explain how our foreign policies are organized around human rights when one is assisting, not just looking the other way, but actually assisting a genocide. So watching all these thousands of children being murdered and still not mustering up the courage to criticize or call on restraints, but instead sending more weapons, I think this is, it's immensely problematic. I think a lot of people are waking up and figuring out something's not really right with this narrative. And that's just Gaza. You can look at Syria. They, you know, the Americans had a bounty on the head of Jolani, and suddenly the next day he's our new friend and ally.
How quickly things change!
Very quickly. Didn't have time to remove the bounty on his head before making him before he was renovated.
Recognizing him.
Yeah. So no longer was he Al Qaeda. He's now he's now a reformist. You know, and he puts on a new coat, a jacket, and. And suddenly, oh, look, he's reformed. And all the newspapers push these ridiculous headlines. And and I think many people were also appalled by what the EU did. That is, when the new authorities in Syria was massacring the Alawites, the EU actually went out with a tweet blaming the Alawites for provoking it. It's quite remarkable and it's so damaging for us as well, for the Europeans, because we were told that these values were central. It's what will bind all the Europeans together. It's what will define us. And then they show how little it's worth, that it can just be, you know, thrown away and dismissed in such a crude manner. So I think, again, it's horrible here for the region, of course, but it's also a lot of self-harm for the Europeans because we're destroying who we were supposed to be.
Of course. And we mentioned Syria, of course. What do you think the situation in that country is going to end up like? Do you think it's going to be like what we witnessed in a certain period in Afghanistan?
I think it's going to be chaos. I think a lot of the partnerships you saw, they were only premised on being anti-Assad. There was a coalition of different countries and groups who wanted to have regime change, to topple him. So you have the United States, you have many of the Europeans, the Saudis, UAE, you have Turkey, you have Israel, all of them kind of playing a role. But once Assad is gone, the anti-Assad coalition is over. Now, what is the new Syria going to look like? And I think it's much more likely now that you're going to see a clash between the different actors. And indeed, I think at the forefront of this, Israel and Turkey is definitely, Turkey would like to see Syria more or less a protectorate of Turkey. Israel, I think they want to carve it up into smaller pieces.
In the beginning, they looked like they had really... They were like allies in this. But now, day by day, they're like kind of facing up to one another. And I think it's another case of just trying to destroy a country in order to gain control, but for control to actually go out of your hands.
Oh, well, this is... I don't think they planned, they had not an exit strategy, but I don't think they planned for the day after. Once the regime change is over, what now? And I think this exposes how little they have in common. I mean, the idea that Israel and Turkey would have a common future, a vision for what Syria should look like, it was always foolish. I remember I wrote an article right after Assad was toppled and pointed out this is... the anti-Assad alliance is over. This is they're going to start to have more tensions. And what about the Americans? How will they? They will probably want to lean more in towards the supporting the Kurds. That will also go against the government there. So, no, it's. I think it's going to be a huge mess.
This is a very interesting conversation, Glenn. We'll be back after a quick break. I want to to talk about, you did a dissertation on EU and NATO relations with Russia. I want to see, of course, nowadays everybody's speaking of forming a new military force in Europe because of the 2% argument for the US and everything. How do you think, how feasible do you think that idea is?
2%? Well, it would have been more feasible before. Now Europe is in a deep economic crisis. Now, on principle, I would think it's a good idea, but it depends. It depends to what's end. To what end? Yeah. If Europe spends military and becomes more self-sufficient, America, then I think it's going to be a positive thing, because when you have huge security dependence on the United States, it will use the security dependence to extract the political concessions, economic loyalty. And this is not. This is why the Europeans often do things which are against their own interest. So if we arm ourselves and push and say, you know, make the Americans, you know, step aside or, you know, go home, then I think this could be positive, because then at least we would use our military to enhance our own national interest. But I don't see this happening. I think it's we're just going to add this to the United States arsenal and look for more military solutions. And from my perspective, that would be, yeah, the worst we can do now, because this was the curse of the unipolar moment. You know, usually the point of departure in security strategy is you want to mitigate or reduce security competition. You can't just have two countries, more weapon is more security. No, you have to reduce the security concerns of your opponents as well. This is usually what security strategies are about. Instead, hegemonic international order, you're so overwhelmingly dominant that no one can, you know, doesn't matter if they're fearful, they can't do anything anyways. This is the hegemonic order. We have to move away from this. This is why when we have conflicts with the Russians, the first impulse is, well, how can we defeat them? But as I said before, the solution, you know, first you pick up the phone to find out if it's necessary to fight this war. And we haven't done this.
Exactly. Thinking about the European pattern, how possible do you think there would be for the Middle East to have the same sort of regional kind of togetherness and unity from a perspective of international relations, sort of convergence?
Well, it should be possible. I mean, we often see, for example, the Gulf states and Iran have tensions, but if you see the things that unite them versus what divides, it's there shouldn't be these tensions to begin with. I think, again, a key curse is how do you organize the international system? And it's been kind of common sense, not anymore, the past 30 years, but it's always been common sense that peacetime alliances are a terrible thing for stability, because it perpetuates conflicts. The entire internal structure and power depends on conflicts continuing. And the problem with the hegemonic order is it's dependent on alliance systems. So look at the United States. As long as you have some tensions between Iran and the Gulf states will be dependent on the United States. Yes. They will have economic, political loyalties because of security dependence, and you can contain and weaken Iran. Now, if peace breaks out, suddenly, you know, Iran's not contained. The Gulf states will start to act more independently of the United States. So there's always this need to perpetuate tensions. And you saw this when the Chinese, because they're not going for hegemony. They wanted to do economic, you know, connectivity with Iran, but also not alienating the Gulf states. So for them, they had an incentive to improve ties. And this is what they did. They were pushing for better relations. And you saw what was the first thing that happened? I saw a former Mossad chief writing an article that, you know, oh, if the Gulf states are not going to be part of this anti-Iranian alliance, maybe we should try to make peace with the Iranians too. And suddenly it looks like peace might break out. But then what is the hegemonic role of the United States? So there's always this need for conflicts and tension. And at the end of the day, I don't think it's good for the United States either. I think they're throwing away the republic in the pursuit of empire. And they're going to lose both at the end. So I think this would be a positive some solution. Just find a way of transitioning away from alliance systems, block politics, and try to move into some inclusive security architecture. Because, you know, both Iran and, for example, Saudi Arabia have a lot of grievances, but you're going to live in the same neighborhood. You're going to have to, you know, yeah. It's in your interest to find a way of living together in a good way. America's away. They don't live here. They don't have that same interest, same as in Europe. They don't have, now that the war went wrong in Ukraine, the continent is on fire, they can go home, which they are. Yeah. And so you should always prioritize your neighbors first and find some inclusive arrangements.
Give me your hand, my brother. I will not let you go. Please don't look back, my sister. I swear I hear your call. Give me your hand, my brother. That's where I hear your call.
Little boy asks away,
where are the streets I used to play?
Don't let go, don't let go.
I hear your call.
Don't you know we're one when you hurt?
Oh,
movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Tour the pit.
On Youth Station.
Youth Station. Youth Station.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحیم. السلام علیکم to all of you dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome to another episode of Youth Station. This is Nahid having the honor of being with you, and here with me I have the pleasure of being with my very dear sister.
Masuma, how are you?
Great. How about you?
Everything is nice.
So are your plans going okay? Is everything fine?
Well, if I start them.
Oh, what do you mean? What if I start them?
I mean, I have plans, obviously, because I want to be successful and all and this and that. But there is a very big barrier. I cannot start it. Sometimes I'm like, I'm waiting for a perfect time.
So let me get it straight. Mm-hmm. You have your plans, but you don't start doing them.
Oh, yes.
Why?
I don't know. It feels like there is no right time for it yet. I'm waiting for the right time. And there is no right time.
So you keep postponing everything for that right moment to come.
Yes, and there is no right time. And I'm running late. Because guess what? Time is not going to wait for me to be ready or the situation to be ready. It's a bit chaotic.
So this can hold you back in life.
It is holding me back in life.
So what do you think we can do to solve it? I mean, do you have any plans, any ideas to start changing?
Well, I did some research, and that said that what I'm suffering is called procrastination.
Yeah.
Yeah, what an ugly name. And the main reasons are either it's out of fear or out of boredom, which I think for me, some of them are out of boredom and some of them are out of fear.
Well, I can feel it.
Like, for example, I have some lesson that I need to start studying it because in some time its exam is gonna come. And I have not done it yet. I have had time, but I have not done it. It has been holding me back. I'm not happy with it. I'm not doing anything with it. And it's been on my nerves a lot. And you know, this is also stopping me. I'm not doing this. I'm not doing anything else perfectly either. You know, it's not only this. It's affecting other stuff too. And I've just realized that it's crazy. It's bad.
And now that you are talking about it, I was thinking of those things. I mean, for all of us, there surely are some different things, maybe different ideas, different mindsets that will keep us back in our life.
Yes.
That will make us just postpone or either don't start something or don't be satisfied.
What holds you back in your life?
Well, as for me, waiting for the perfect moment. You know, I sometimes start doing something. Mm-hmm. I am so excited about it. I try to put all my energy and effort in it, but then I'm not satisfied.
Oh.
I mean, there is this mindset in my mind that what you're doing is not the perfect thing that it should be. And this makes me stop or quit. Even.
Oh.
Yeah, in some cases, I simply quit. Because
you just let it go?
Because I didn't feel like this is going to satisfy me. Let me give you an example. A few days ago at work, I was going to start writing a new kind of, say, lesson plan for a new book, the kind of syllabus.
Nice.
So I started doing it. I did the first two chapters. Then I got too busy. I mean, I was really pressurized that week. So I said, okay, I don't have time to make it perfect. And what I've already designed does not sound interesting to me. It is not the perfect thing that I want. So I give it up.
And you just left it?
Yeah.
Oh.
And I postponed it to you later, maybe another time, that I have more time, I have more energy. I can make it that perfect thing that I want.
Well, the word perfect sounds very scary.
Yeah.
Especially when you have to satisfy yourself.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm sure for all our listeners, there are different things, different mindsets that will make us stop, make us just keep doing something or even giving up or quitting, letting go of the interesting, exciting, favorite things that we were supposed to do. So, as we mentioned up to now, one of them was the procrastination, right?
Yes.
And as for me, we can say it was kind of perfectionism problem.
Yes.
What are the other things that will keep us stay at one moment, one part of our life, and not move on?
It can be overthinking.
Yeah,
also,
exactly.
Have you experienced
it? Yeah, a lot.
Like, overthinking, you might think that it might help, but overthinking does not help.
Yeah, for sure.
You need to take a... For example, I remember there was something on my mind, and I couldn't really do anything about it. It was just from my side, not anything interesting. Like, nobody else could help mm-hmm. me with it. It was right. just within me, right? And it was not something like a problem, we could call it, to call help and let others help me. I kept overthinking about it until I started speaking about it to some of my friends. Of course, I know that they are very honest, nice, and wise friend. I need to mention that. Yes. So I talked to them, and they made me not to overthink, but think wisely.
Wow.
So I started
and
like...
Did it work?
It worked.
Because we usually mm-hmm. read books, we usually listen to podcasts, but when it comes into practice, it gets hard. Because
it takes time, you know?
Yeah.
It takes time. For me, I spent some time overthinking, and it did hurt me. And when I realize this thinking is not healing me, is not helping me, so it's overthinking.
Yeah,
then
course.
I just started thinking a bit different, a bit more practical, and my case was solved.
So everything goes relieved. Back to our mind, the way we're thinking.
Yes.
And sometimes even what I felt is that these negative or low energy circle of friends, this can also affect. I mean, once I used to be with some of my classmates, say, and I didn't choose to be there. I mean,
yeah,
it was
course.
A class. We had to be next to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And since during the day, I'm a bit busy and I experience different places, different atmospheres.
Yes.
So in that place, I could feel that I'm not being energetic. And the reason was that the people surrounding me were not energetic people.
Mm-hmm.
They were kind of disappointed, sad, forced to work. So this atmosphere, this feeling, this place
social
made
environment.
Me also be deactivated. I mean,
yes.
I used to get ready, be energetic, and start the day. Once I entered that place, it was like a button that you pushed and my energy would be reduced. And then I was sad. I didn't have that power to start doing anything. And once I left that place and entered the next place that I had to work, that energy would come back. So, I mean, the circle of friends, people around us will also
yes.
affect.
I totally agree with you because I have had some classes because I teach.
Yeah.
I've had some classes that the
oh,
students...
Oh, with classes. Have you seen
goodness.
Those students?
Oh, my goodness. See, I have experienced amazing students that have motivated me to teach better, to know
yeah.
more, to pursue for a better source of knowledge. That excitement, because I have experienced that, when a class is boring, they don't work hard, and they're nagging, oh, it takes away my soul.
Yeah.
It's hard. Like,
right.
the timing is the same. It's the same 80 minutes, the same 90 minutes, but oh my God, my soul is taken away.
Yeah, and these are, I think, the opportunities that are just being lost under the reasons of being, I don't know, not energetic or overthinking something, even being scared of failure.
Mm-hmm.
Many people are scared of failing. That's why they just reject any opportunity that arises
yes.
for them. But regarding Islam, regarding our religion, Imam Ali alayhi salam had mentioned, opportunity passes like a cloud, seize it. So we are supposed to have our eyes open to everything that we're facing, to everything that we're seeing. Maybe in that moment that I felt like what I did was not that good,
mm-hmm.
this is the opportunity for me, either to start better, or to just choose another way to change my mindset, my opportunity, to change this place into a better one. So maybe we are losing the opportunities for the fear of failure as well.
Yes, I totally can understand that because a friend of mine, she's an amazing writer, and she has amazing stories and plots. If she's listening to this, she's going to know. I'm talking about you, girl. She has amazing plots in her mind, but she never starts writing because she fears what if it's not that perfect as she wants it to be.
Wow.
And that has been annoying me. It has been 2 years.
That is a mixture of both our problems.
Yes.
Procrastination
yeah.
plus perfectionism.
It is. And it has been 2 years I've been with her, and I can still see she has not made any improvement yet just because of that little fear. I know
oh.
if she would start, it would get amazingly
better. Oh,
that is
scary.
It is scary.
So there are many things in our minds that
yes.
will stop us. We named lots of them. Or even some people quit things when they get difficult. I mean, regarding the educational system, since we're both teachers, so our listeners are also get to know more about the educational groups of the society.
Mm-hmm.
Regarding education, I've done some researches in our own small institute to see what happens that the students give up. And the result was fascinating. I mean, our students, they didn't give up when they were about to get their diploma or finish. They didn't give up at the first stages of their lessons. I mean, the place that it was new, strange, queer, they didn't know anything. But guess when did they quit?
When?
At the time that they were getting ready to be improved. I mean, not the advanced level, neither the elementary. They quit when they were in the pre-intermediate or intermediate levels. The lessons were about to get a bit hard, mm-hmm. so they felt it and quit.
They were scared to get out of their comfort zone?
Yeah, exactly. And that was the reason that they quit. I mean, this was the start point mm-hmm. of their own journey to get improved, to be advanced, to finish everything, to end the thing that they have started. And they would have quit at this stage. They felt something is going to be difficult.
And you know what makes me more sad? That they would never know this.
Yeah.
And it's very bad that we don't know why we are being stopped.
Exactly.
So, for example, in my case, when I understood I'm overthinking, I could help myself. When I understood that I am procrastinating, I can find some solutions to get out of it. But, oh, God forbid the time that we don't know what the matter is, what the problem is. That's
crazy. Exactly. When we don't know and we're just neglecting things mm-hmm. with no reason, this is worse even. Well, let's go for the last break of today, and then we're going to be back by some solutions now that we just nagged and complained a lot from the beginning of the problems that will hold us back in life. Let's go for this break, and then we're going to find some solutions as well.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
Welcome back with today's episode. We were talking about things that hold us back in life. So we named lots of them.
Indeed.
How should we change?
For me, first step was knowing the problem, which... If we overcome,
acknowledging that there is a problem is the most important part.
When you understand the problem and then you can solve it, I think we need to take steps. It can be, now this is the era of knowledge. You have everything under your fingertips. Just give it a search, read some articles. Of course, be very much sure what you're reading is correct information and not just a bunch of words. Right. And then if you have some wise friends around you or some teachers that you trust or someone maybe in your relatives who's knowledgeable, a therapist, if you trust them, just go for it. Ask questions from others, wise people, and make changes in your life.
Yeah, and the other thing is that we can also start the change from inside. I mean, I'm not saying that we shouldn't talk to other people, we shouldn't consult. Mm-hmm. No, that is never the thing that I want to mention. What I'm after is that once we go inside ourselves, we open our eyes to the truth, we acknowledge that there is a problem, and then we look around. What am I surrounding myself with? Am I surrounding myself with a phone, with the internet, with the technology, and I'm just postponing everything because of those reasons? You know how media and social media affects? I'm not going to be that person, so I'm not going to do it. Those role models, fake role models that we're seeing, I mean, from inside, from the very personal spot, we can see the places that we are making the mistakes in, the places that we want to be, what we can't.
When you said inside, I remember this verse from Surah Al-A'raf, verse 11 in Quran we have, indeed, Allah will not change the condition of a people until they change what is in themselves.
So true.
So the first, I think, one of the most important stages is to change yourself within. And of course, Allah is there to help you.
Yeah, and the other thing that will start is rooted from inside. Is looking around. As I said, we have to be aware of the people that are surrounding us.
Very important.
Is our life, and this is the only one limited time that we have on this world. So we can look around. We can see what kind of people am I in touch with. So those people can decide. Those people can have impact on the way that I'm acting.
Yes.
As Imam Sadiq alayhi salam had mentioned, avoid the lazy and hopeless, for they spoil your work.
Indeed.
See how they're going to spoil your work. They're going to ruin whatever you're doing without you knowing that this is going to happen in your life. So also being aware of the people that are around us can help. So what else? What other things can help us?
I think those few points are more than enough if we do them.
Yeah, that's the point. Yes. We usually name like 100 things. Yes. And then when it comes to practice, they even get harder.
Yeah, they get harder. Like those simple little words.
Now I'm on the chaos of choosing which one to go for. So
I'm going to go for it changing inside and then worshiping, asking Allah to guide me, and then changing my environment as much as I can.
Exactly. So true. So choosing the right path depends on the way that I'm looking at myself. I'm looking at my problems and the way I'm looking inside. And with the wish that you will find the best way that works for you to. First of all, we hope that none of our listeners is going to have this kind of problems that will hold them back. But in case we do, since we're all human beings and we do have problems and places that we need to work on, with the wish that the strategies you choose will work the best for you, we will end today's episode. Until the next time that we're together, we wish you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum.
Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I will tell you, dear youth, that the future belongs to you. By Allah's favor, you, dear youth, will see that day, and you will hand down your sources of pride to the future generations. Greetings. Be upon you and Allah's mercy and blessings.
And inshallah, we will continue talking about
this. We'll discuss that inshallah in the next session. Wassalamu alaikum.
Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. And don't go away.
We will continue this very essential topic with our great youth.
Wassalamu alaikum. Wassalamu alaikum. Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hazrat Fatima alayha salam is the role model for women throughout history and for all. In her short life, Fatima al-Zahra, peace be upon her, achieved the position as the primary woman of all females. In other words, she is superior to all great and saintly women throughout history. What factors, forces, and what kind of inner strength could lead one person to become such a notion of wisdom, piety, sanctity, and spiritual transcendence in such a short time? This is a miracle of Islam. Another pivotal matter is in regards to the blessed descendants of this great person, Lady Fatima Zahra, peace be upon her. The association of Surah Al-Kawthar with Fatima Zahra, peace be upon her, even if such an association had not existed in our collection of hadith, is an accurate association. There are so many blessings that have been bestowed upon the Holy Prophet's household and on each and every one of the Imams, peace be upon them. The world is full of enjoyable individual, social, worldly, and otherworldly melodies which rose from the pure lungs of the Imams, peace be upon them. Husayn ibn Ali, Zainab al-Kubra, Imam Hassan al-Mujtaba, Imam Sadiq, Imam Sajjad, peace be upon them all, each and every one of the Imams would produce these melodies. See, what great excitement exists in the world of spirituality and on the path of guidance because of the words of these great personalities and their lessons and teachings. They are the children of Fatima Zahra, peace be upon her. We should make greater efforts towards emulating Fatima Zahra, alayha salam. Lessons to be learned from the life of Siddiqatul Tahira Fatima al-Zahra alayha salam involve making great efforts, showing diligence, and leading a pure life, just as that great personality, the manifestation of enlightenment and purity, led her life. She was pure, immaculate, virtuous, and pious. Traits of purity, piety, enlightenment of such an exceptional person are what have influenced our Islamic teachings throughout the history of Shia Islam. In the history of Islam, for every group or stratum of society, there is a suitable role model whose guiding light for salvation and on the path to perfection. The role model for women, as declared by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and His Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam, is Hazrat Fatima Zahra alayha salam. As rightly stated by the noble Prophet, Fatima is the best of all women of the world, Sayyidat Nisa'il Alameen, and a role model for all Muslim women. Referring to this, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi said, "The history of Islam is witness to the immense respect that the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam had for Hadrat Zahra alayha salam, which also powerfully reflects on the importance of women in society. If they are not superior to men, they are definitely not any inferior."
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Every day I witness calamity. Every day I witness your tragedy. When my Lord gave me my eyes, He drew on them your figure. So wherever I your beauty I would picture, but then my eyes would see the last son of Ali alone, no family crying, who will help me? But then my eyes would see the last son of Ali alone, no family crying, who will help me? As by walls you are circled, and I watch as my beloved is killed. Every day it's with me a memory. Every day I witness your tragedy. Within the realm of your love, I awoke and I wondered, whenever I called your name,
was